Before I start, I will read this obligatory statement. CDC, our planners and presenters in this session wish to disclose they have no financial interest. You know that part. Here's the important part. Presentations in this session will not include any discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or a product under investigational use, with the exception of me, who will discuss the use of meningococcal and pneumococcal conjugate vaccines in a manner not approved by the Food and Drug Administration, but recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices.
Well done, Dr. Atkins.
Thank you so much. It's not possible for me to summarize what I was asked to summarize in 15 minutes. This is an incomplete list, actually, of all of the new recommendations or modified recommendations made by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice just since last August. Not included on here was some information about MMR immunity evidence in healthcare workers, yellow fever, some other things. And you can see that most of these have now been published. I'm sure you all get those publications through the electronic MMWR. A few are still provisional, meaning they technically haven't been published yet, so I will comment on some of those. So I'm not going to talk about all of these. I would like to concentrate on just a couple, three things, mainly the ones, because it's a challenge to try to, you all know this already, so it's a challenge to try to find maybe something you maybe missed or overlooked or hadn't paid attention to, so I will try to do that. First off, there was the schedule that was published on January 8th, 2010, as it now has been for the last number of years. It seems like there's never a year that goes by that we don't find something that we missed during the arduous clearance and publication process. All the changes, a lot of the things that happened at least up through January were actually included in the 2010 schedule. I'm going to comment on the combination vaccine statement, but things like the age and interval for the last dose of IPV, meningococcal conjugate revaccination, a use of HPV2 and HPV4 for males, a permissive, one thing that I'm not going to talk about is a permissive recommendation for the use of hepatitis A vaccine in individuals older than 23 months, but all these are included in the 2010 schedule, and I'm sure you have certainly by now absorbed all of the 5.5-point font footnotes. I would like to comment on this box. This is that little box. It's right below the grid. The grid is the top part. The box is the bottom part, because actually a very important change was made in the wording of that box. And it had to do with the use of combination vaccines. And this is really the first time this has actually sort of formally seen the light of day. And I wanted to let you know. There's been a statement about combination vaccines in the schedule, on the schedule, since 1999. And since that time, it's gone something like this. Licensed combination vaccines may be used whenever any components of the combination is indicated and other components are not contraindicated. And it goes on a little bit more. That got changed this year. It got changed to the wording that you can see here, and it may be somewhat subtle, but it was very important because it really sort of culminated about a year's worth of discussion. The use of a combination vaccine is generally preferred over separate injections of its equivalent component vaccines, and this is the new wording about combination vaccines that now is here and will also then, subsequent to this, be show up in the general recommendations on immunization. And I won't go into detail, but it basically has a lot to do with a long discussion of MMRV. You haven't heard the last of MMRV. In fact, there's a session on Wednesday about MMRV and adverse reactions, and if you have interest in this, I'd encourage you to check out that. One other thing that some of you careful readers have noticed that I did not, unfortunately, looking at the final proof, was up there in the corner. Notice there are yellow bars on this schedule, and the bars indicate a range of ages for that particular dose. All right, you know that. We've had bars on the schedule for a long time. But what it said on those bars was this is the range of recommended ages for all children except certain high-risk groups. Now, to be honest, this was a negotiation point. The editor of MMWR actually inserted that wording, and it was during the negotiations that we always go through in the publication process, and it was to sort of be a counterpoint to the purple bar, which is the range of recommended ages for certain high-risk groups. But in fact, it's not really true. It says it's a range except for children of certain high-risk groups, which implies that there's a different range of recommended ages for children in high-risk groups, which is not true. So actually, that's a bit of a confusing statement, and several people have pointed this out to us. This is really not correct. The yellow bar is a range of ages for all children, not just for those who are not in a high-risk group. So we will be sure that that legend is modified for the 2011 statement, which will come out, the 2011 schedule, which will come out in January of 2011. Next, I'd like to just make a couple of comments about meningococcal conjugate vaccine recommendation, which has been a very major source of questions over the last several months. This is also published, you can see here, it was published in MMWR on September 29th. You know what the recommendations are, but in fact, in our Q&A session this morning, this came up again about who exactly should be revaccinated. These are the groups that are considered to be the highest risk for meningococcal disease, and these are the groups that it's now recommended should then be revaccinated after 3 to 5 years, depending on the age of the first dose. Those with persistent complement component deficiency, and some of you careful readers also noted that last year and before this was terminal complement component deficiency. It's now been changed to persistent complement component deficiency, anatomic or functional asplenia, microbiologists who are doing the plating, who are exposed perhaps to aerosols, and frequent travelers, which will probably end up being the largest group who end up being revaccinated, are those folks who go in and out of the meningitis belt in Africa. The important caveat on all this, and sometimes people stop reading and don't read the whole thing, is that meningococcal conjugate revaccination is not recommended at this time for persons whose only risk factor is living in on-campus housing, college students living in a dormitory. This has been discussed at some length and several times by the meningococcal working group, and at this point they are not going forward and recommending that if a healthy child is going to college and was vaccinated when they were, say, 11 or 12 years old, that is not a group currently being recommended to receive. However, if that child received a dose of polysaccharide vaccine earlier, then that would be appropriate to revaccinate that child with meningococcal conjugate. The other thing that has slipped by some people is that this is not a one-time revaccination event like it is for pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine. This is an ad infinitum revaccination event, which means that it will go on forever until the person is no longer at high risk. And somehow I don't think if we can find a way to regrow a spleen, then perhaps that will be taking them out. But some people say a microbiologist might retire or a missionary might decide not to go back to Africa and won't have that risk. But a couple of those, persistent complement component asplenia, are going to be present for the person's life. And so this is an every 5 year recommendation. I would also like to point out that it was not stated specifically in the MMWR article a couple of weeks ago, but actually the new Novartis MCV can also be used as a revaccination dose. Once a person reaches age 56, then revaccination should be accomplished with polysaccharide vaccine, since the conjugate vaccine is not currently approved for people older than 55. And this was the other topic that has been very common that we've gotten a lot of questions on is now the availability of pneumococcal conjugate vaccine 13 valent. These recommendations also have been published, although not as fairly recently, in fact. In fact, I haven't gone back and really documented this, but I believe this is a world record. Number one, the recommendations were actually voted on the very day that the vaccine was approved by the Food and Drug Administration, and that's not the best part. The best part is the ACIP recommendations were actually published 3 weeks later, which has never happened. 3 months, yeah, 6 months, yeah, a year later maybe, but never 3 weeks. So this is really a watershed point that really reflects the efforts of a lot of people to get these recommendations out into the hands of those of you who need them fairly quickly after they're made. You know what the recommendations are. The basic recommendations for pneumococcal conjugate vaccine 13 valent are really no different. The fundamental ones are no different than for pneumococcal 7 valent vaccine, old Prevnar. All children through 59 months, 4 doses. You see the schedule. Fewer doses if started at 7 months of age or older, and therein lies the about 90% of the questions that we receive. And of course, those who have started on PCV7 should finish their series if possible with PCV13. I want to go back to this. Fewer doses have started at 7 months of age or older. This is by far the most common area that we get questions about children who are off schedule or behind schedule or have a lapsed schedule for both either the pneumococcal conjugate or HIB vaccine. This little table was included in the March 12th MMWR article that gives a basic recommendation about the use of kids who use how many doses a child should receive if they have started the series late. You'll notice they have a pretty basic schedule that basically just has four age groups and the number of total doses. Unfortunately, to the inquiring mind out there in a clinic, this will not be sufficient because this is not reality. It's not that children don't get any and then start at 7 months. They get one at two and then they show back up at 12, or they show back up at 11 and a half, or they show back up at 20 months of age, and then you have to figure out what to do. So this is something that you'll need to make a mental note on if you haven't already done it. In the provisional recommendations published on the website, there's this table, which is an expansive version of that table that just has the basic, you know, when you start and how many doses. This one gives you all the permutations. Because of space limitations that is enforced very strictly by MMWR, it was not possible to include this table in the MMWR article. It will be presumably included in the full ACIP statement once it is published probably later this year. I would strongly suggest you get a copy of this because this is by far the most common source of questions that we get with all the various permutations, a six-month-old or seven-month-old who got one dose and then skipped a year and then came back. So keep a copy of this, but you'll need to go to the ACIP provisional website to get it. It's also in the VFC resolution if you want to look there. So get a copy of this because this will help you work yourself through a lot of those lapsed schedule situations. This is the new part of the PCV13 recommendations, is the supplemental dose, and there's three versions of this depending on the child's basic age and health. For children who've already finished a whole series of PCV7, a single PCV13 dose is recommended at least 8 weeks later through age 59 months if the child is healthy. If the child has an underlying illness, the age for that supplemental dose moves back a year to age 71 months. So children should receive a single supplemental dose of PCV13 up through age 71 months. They were able to include a table that lists all of these underlying conditions. They shouldn't be anything new to you. These are all the various underlying conditions which would indicate a supplemental dose through age 71 months as opposed to 59 months for healthy kids. And then this is the off-label part because PCV13 is only approved through children 71 months actually and younger, is that ACIP now also recommends a supplemental dose for the very highest risk children through 18 years of age. That would include children without a functional spleen, including sickle cell disease, HIV infection, cochlear implant, and CSF leak. Those, anyone up through age 18 should do that. Now, in the MMWR article, those of you who are careful readers may have noticed that this group only included sickle cell disease. And after it was published, we discussed this with the pneumococcal folks who agreed that, in fact, that was only one way one can lose their spleen, that it was probably more appropriate to include anatomic or functional asplenia, including sickle cell disease, not just sickle cell disease as the indication for a supplemental dose through age 18 years. So be aware that there is a slight difference. And also the VFC resolution is a little bit different than this and is probably going to need to be revised at the next ACIP meeting. And you'll all be extremely pleased to know that finally, the pneumococcal PCV13 VIS has been posted to the CDC website after exactly 100 trillion requests from all of you and every single provider in the entire country. Yes, we have finally done it. It was posted on Friday. Hopefully you all got the email and you've now got them all in your clinics. I have never seen, I guess it's a good thing that we have so many people fixated on VISs so intently. I'm happy to see it. It's become like a part of immunization life, which is the way it should be, because I swear we got dozens of these every single day wanting to know when was the PCV13 thing. So it's here. It's here now. It'll take a little while to get it translated and all that, so it'll be back. We'll have it. There'll be translations of it available probably in the next several months. So what's next? This is not all. Whoever does this talk next year will probably have a whole litany of things to discuss as well. Additional combination vaccines, including the anticipation of a combination vaccine of Hib and meningococcal conjugate for infants. That has been creating some very interesting discussions with the meningococcal working group. It will open the door to perhaps we should be recommending meningococcal vaccine for all infants rather than those starting just at 2 years of age. And so that's an evolving situation that you'll hear more about. We anticipate that it's likely that the age range for HPV4 for Gardasil will be increased to more than 26 years, we think. That's an action that is an FDA-dependent thing. You'll be very happy to know, as I'm sure you all do now, that we can just, you all live through a historic time that you got to use monovalent H1N1 vaccine. None of your predecessors, well, I guess back in 77, if you're still there, they did. So no more monovalent vaccine. We won't have to deal with that issue next year. It'll all be, there'll be some other issues we'll have to deal with, but not monovalent vaccine. And the next ACIP meeting is June 23rd and 24th here in Atlanta. Come on down, see how immunization policy is made. You'll be impressed. Or you can watch it on the website in the comfort of your own home. Thank you very much. Close.
We do have time for a question or two. Any questions for Bill about that whirlwind tour through this? Changes in the schedule? Oh yeah, I see a hand in the back. Is that a question? Yeah, okay, you might need to come to the microphone, but go ahead, maybe I'll be able to hear you. Okay. Oh, we have two questions over here. Oh, while you're going, go ahead, question one.
My question, Bill, is about why the VIS does take the amount of time that it takes, because I'm sure that you guys know it's coming, but just give us a little enlightenment.
Internal clearance. That's all I can say. Internal clearance. It's got to be cleared by a lot of people. It's got to be looked at by a lot of different strata of individuals, and we got to make sure it's correct, and it's internal clearance, which you're right, we knew it was coming, but really you can't do the VIS until you're certain of the indications. And you really need the vote, and you really need you need to know what the indications are and the contraindications before you can do the VIS. So having the VIS is dependent on finally having approved, and we start that process immediately, but it just takes a while to get things cleared through CDC. It's just the way it is. We try.
I think my question is a similar one. I'm Isabel Claxton, head of public policy with GSK. And 3 weeks for PCV13, fantastic. A year for Gardasil, maybe not so fantastic, even though that's a competitor vaccine. Why does it take so long? And many in the, VFC is a entitlement, so technically once the VFC resolution is made, VFC children should be entitled to that vaccine. In the public sector, major managed care organizations, including United, which is the largest in the US, will not offer a vaccine in the private sector until the MMWR formal published. So, we in industry turn around a press release in a day based on the ACPI recommendation. What takes so long?
A lot of people need to read it. Now, for what I can tell you is that we have been working very hard, and I give a lot of credit to Larry Pickering and Gene Smith and the folks in the ACIP office who have really done a yeoman's job. That's why the PCV thing got done so fast. And we have tried to explore new mechanisms to publish ACIP because we know that's the case. We know that a lot of people are waiting for they don't believe provisional recommendations. They got to see it in MMWR. It's got to be printed. And and have really begun to find other ways to bypass the need to put together these huge encyclopedic statements and instead publish the nuts and bolts of it fairly quickly, like was done here. There will be a new pneumococcal ACIP statement, but it may be later this year. And this is called now a policy note. It's a new thing in MMWR, and I know that they are working on the HPV one as we speak. So this has only really evolved into something that was usable in the past few months, that we've actually sort of gotten that door open and are able to actually use that mechanism to get short reports of policy implication into MMWR much more quickly. So I think from this going forward from this point, you're going to find a lot quicker turnaround. So you will have them in black and white, and you'll have them that you can show your insurers and whatnot. And I think that you're going to find that in the future, it's not going to take as long. Unfortunately, HPV was, those things were approved, and it was a little different story because they're working on it, and I expect a policy note on HPV vaccine, including Cervarix, to come out any time in the next couple of months.
And
so.
That's great, truly, because ACIP pretty much mandates market access, public and private sector. Yeah,
thank you. Yep, thanks very much. We have time for maybe one more very quick question and a quick answer.
Quick. Hi, I'm Joellen from Michigan, and Joellen Walicki, and I have a plea. Can you help me understand and then explain to my providers why some high-risk children 6 through 18 years of age do not get PCV13 but need PPSV23? So for example, a diabetic child, based on the slide, would not be indicated for PCV13 if they were 6 through 18, but yet they need PPSV23. Thanks.
No quick answer to that. It would require, I'll be happy to talk to you a little later about it, and it has a lot to do with the machinations of the folks who generate the pneumococcal recommendations, and I can't answer that question. But I know who can. So I will find out, and I will get back to you, Joellen. Thank you.